Hi, and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is the Reverend Lillian Daniel. Reverend Daniel is a noted preacher, teacher, and writer, and she jokes on her website that while she has taught preaching in a number of schools, including the Chicago Theological Seminary and the Yale Divinity School, she cannot be held responsible for everyone who falls asleep in church. Her new book, Tired of Apologizing for a Church I Don't Belong To, is generating much conversation about the changing religious landscape in our country, and it continues the theme of her 2013 book, When Spiritual But Not Religious Is Not Enough, about the growing number of people who claim none as their religious preference. In this episode, we talk about her books, what it means to apologize and confess, and explore the state of the mainline church. I hope you enjoy it. Well, welcome, Reverend Lillian Daniel, to the Failing Boldly podcast. It's great to have you a part of this program.
Thanks, Christian. Great to be here.
Yeah. So I usually ask folks to talk about their own story of how they came into their own vocation, whether it is a religious vocation or not. So I was wondering if you could share with the folks who are listening how you came to be into the ministry.
Well, in a sense, my coming into the ministry is a huge failure story because I was, you know, initially turned down in the ordination process.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I was raised Episcopalian and really Anglican because we grew up overseas. So I was a very happy Episcopalian and started the ordination process right after college. I'd already been accepted to divinity school. I didn't know you were supposed to check with the church first on all that stuff, you know. And anyway, that summer after graduating, went into the Episcopal ordination process, went through all the psychological testing and this and that, and ended up getting weeded out in no uncertain terms.
What was that like to have that come back to you? Was there somebody who told you? Were they kind about it? What was that like?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, it was awesome. It's what you dream of. Yeah. No, so there was a committee that was led by some people in the church, and there was like a transition in leadership. And so I hadn't been a part of the church with the new minister. And so he put together this committee. And anyway, it was the chair of the committee. They were the discernment committee, and they wrote me a letter and brought me in and told me I had no discernible gifts for ministry whatsoever.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, they said I was a thrill seeker, that I had issues with authority, and that I was immature. And yeah, which I mean, all of which was true, but like, if that excludes you from ministry, I don't know, you know, where we're going to be.
Actually, that's a pretty good, I think it's a pretty good summary of Jesus, all of those things.
I don't think they were saying that. So yeah, they were, and it was really devastating, of course. You know, I was devastated and I took it very seriously. I mean, I thought, okay, that's it. God's saying no. And so I was supposed to go to divinity school. I canceled my plans and called them up, and they said, I was like, I'm canceling. And the lady was like, one does not cancel coming to Yale Divinity School. One defers. And so I was like, well, I don't know what that means, but put me down for that. So I said, how long can I defer? She said, 2 years. I said, okay. But I said, I'm not going to come. You know, I've been told no. But 2 years later, I went anyway.
So what happened in those 2 years? Did you get a sense that I'm not sure they know what they're talking about? Or did someone tell you that I'm not sure those people knew what they were talking about?
Yeah. So, basically, I was trying to get somebody to say that to me, and nobody would, because nobody thought I should be a minister in the first place. Like, it wasn't like when I said, oh, I'm going to divinity school, people said, oh, that makes so much sense. Instead, people were like, really? You know, so I was not getting any affirmation. And it was also the high point when there was a real celebration of second career ministers. Mm. And I, you know, I was straight out of college. Okay. And so everyone was very enamored with the partner in the law firm, or this person's been a chemistry teacher for 20 years. And, you know, Lillian, what do you bring to the table? And I was like, well, I worked at a movie theater and I've done some babysitting, you know. So I was devastated. And so what they recommended is, they said I didn't have a pastoral ability, but they thought I should get an MBA and use my gifts in the nonprofit world.
Really?
To serve God that way. So yeah, so I was working in the business department of U.S. News and World Report magazine, which I hated because I wasn't on the editorial side. I was literally like in the business side of it. And I was volunteering at a homeless shelter for youth in DC, and I ended up getting a job there. And so I was trying to pursue my vocation that way. And at the nonprofit, Sasha Bruce Youth Work, it's an amazing nonprofit in DC, I was shocked to find out that we were getting these interns who were from Howard Divinity School. And one of the things the Episcopal Church had told me was that I couldn't articulate a clear vocation to parish ministry because they kept asking me about the Eucharist and how I felt about it and, you know, whether I was sort of called to do that. And I was like, whatever, I'm fine with that. I'll do the Eucharist, you know, which is the wrong answer to give to an Episcopalian. And so, you know, they kept saying that like I had a calling, but it wasn't to the parish. So here we get these three Baptist divinity students as interns at this secular nonprofit. And I was like, what the heck kind of a church would consider this training for ministry? Don't you understand you're supposed to be thinking about the Eucharist? And they were like, what kind of church would not consider this ministry? And that was my sort of really my first moment that it ever occurred to me there were different understandings of ministry and different churches.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so then I told them my whole sad story. And I said, you know, my church has told me no. And they said, maybe you're in the wrong church. And that was like the first affirmation I had. And I was like, oh, that must be a word from God. I better go to school anyway. Yeah. But I mean, it was more than that. They actually said at the end of their intern year at the agency, you know, we all became close. And they said that they had a prayer group attached to their class at the seminary. And they'd been praying for me and that it came to all three of them that I was meant to go to divinity school anyway, even without the blessing of a church, and that God would figure that out.
That's a great story.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard to go to divinity school with a failure under your belt. So by then, you know, I was trying to figure out what I would tell people at Yale Divinity School because I couldn't say I was there with the blessing of the ordination process. So I told myself and other people I was going to get like a dual degree. You know, I was going to go to law school or, and I was just picking up this master's. But of course, you know, what I really felt was like, I'm a fraud. I'm a failure. What am I doing here?
Did you find out, and I don't know if, I guess it depends on the divinity school or the seminary where they try to encourage others to be vulnerable in that way. I'm not sure I belong here, but I guess my stereotype of Yale students is that folks aren't necessarily going to offer that.
Yeah. And you know, in some ways, I mean, I loved my time there and it was good for me, but my first year there was really difficult because I was in vocational crisis, you know, and it seemed to me like everyone else was so together and impressive. And they give you this big speech on your first day there about this percentage of you have a 4.0 grade point average and this percent of you are concert piano players and, you know, on and on. They list all these things. And, you know, I'm sitting there going, well, I didn't have those grades. I can't play the piano. I don't even have a call from my church. Like, what am I doing here? And then, of course, you get to know people and you realize they're all neurotic and crazy and confused. But it was great because it was in a university setting. So it wasn't like everybody had to have a call from the church. There were lots of other people there on similarly sort of twisted journeys. So I didn't stand out that much by saying I wanted to get a dual degree.
You know? It was a little bit, it seems like, I don't know if ahead of their time or your time in saying that, because it seems like today, from what I understand in theological schools, there are a lot of students who are getting an MDiv and have really no desire to go into the ministry. And so your being there at the time when you were talking about double masters, like I said, may have been a little bit ahead of its time.
I think so. And also because so many people were on the academic track, like to be a professor. And I had been a religion major in college. So that did become my sort of default. I said, I'm going to go on and get a PhD and teach, you know, history of Christian thought or something like that. But then I discovered the Congregational Church. And it was at that moment in time, it felt like it had a very different understanding of what ministry was that corresponded a lot more to my kind of low ecclesiology, low view of ordination.
Well, that was the beginning of a really impressive career, vocation in your own local church ministry and as an author too. And so, as I noted in the beginning of the podcast, that you have recently written a book called Tired of Apologizing for a Church I Don't Belong To. And I think you make a pretty compelling case for why Christians should think twice about apologizing for the damage that the church or faith has done over its history. So I'm wondering, for our listeners, if you could just say a little bit more about the premise of the book and what spurred you to write it.
Yeah. So first, I mean, when we have done things wrong, we should apologize for them. You know, totally in favor of that. It's called like confession and repentance, sort of core doctrine, right? But what I was talking about was this sort of neurotic apologizing that many in the sort of so-called liberal or mainline churches will do, where they're sort of fake apologizing for these other types of Christians who they consider themselves superior to, or maybe genuinely trying to reach people who've been injured by, you know, the church in some way. But there's this sort of like compulsive apologizing and sort of self-loathing that happens. And I think that, you know, for the last 50 years, that was our evangelism plan, was like apologizing and self-loathing. And then, you know, people would realize we were really humble and really nice, and they would want to come. And of course, it's not a very compelling vision.
It seems like, too, that I can't remember if you said this specifically in the book, but some folks, too, are almost embarrassed to be a Christian.
Absolutely. And so, you know, you have this sort of fast, you know, vision of history of religion in the last 50 years. But like you have in the 80s and 90s, the predominant view of Christianity in the media becomes right-wing, conservative, homophobic, moral majority, et cetera, et cetera. And at that same time, you have all these mainline people who almost go in the closet because they don't want to be associated with that. And so they have this sort of don't ask, don't tell attitude about their faith. And so then that sort of increases the skewed vision of who gets to represent Christianity. And we could go on and on about why the media chooses this group or that group. And, you know, why isn't the head of the Methodist Church on there commenting on the news? Why is it always the nutcase, you know, crazy preacher who says like, oh, that hurricane hit those people because they were evil. Like, you know, we can drive ourselves crazy with that. But my book is really aimed at like sort of the thoughtful layperson or clergy person who says, why am I embarrassed to talk about how I experience God in this amazing thing called the church? And let's unpack that and maybe, you know, sort of expose the sort of false modesty for what it is, ineffective.
I don't know if you, this is a few years ago, I saw this article in The Onion, actually, and the article, I think the title of the article was something like, a gay young person comes out as Christian.
Exactly.
Because I think there is that some of that. I think, to talk about myself and our church a little bit, that was one of the reasons why we decided to start this church too, because we kind of felt the same thing, that there was, we believe in this pretty remarkable, what we would call Lord named Jesus, who can do some pretty remarkable things. And we don't want to feel ashamed about talking about that.
Yeah. And also, I think we don't want to participate in the stereotyping that's already happening with Christianity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we sit around talking to each other about why doesn't the media put our person on the news, blah, 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 but then we won't tell anybody that we're a Christian.
Right.
You know, we're relinquishing responsibility for that. So when I talk about the tired of apologizing, you know, the sort of imaginary scenario I have is somebody says to the Christian person who's sort of open-minded and, you know, welcoming and stuff, and it's like, well, what about, you know, the Inquisition and what about the Salem witch trials? And the classic response is like, I know, I'm so sorry for that. Like, you know, we're really ashamed of that. Like, I feel your pain. Instead of saying, you know what, that's really not a fair way to describe Christianity today. We're a diverse group. Let me tell you about my community. You know, it's not like that preacher you saw on the news. Yeah. And when people say things like, well, I can't, you know, I can't believe you'd be a Christian because of this or that, you know, horrible thing that happened in history, to push back and say, wow, would you talk about any other group of people in the same way that you just spoke about Christians? Mm-hmm. You know, like, would you say, oh, I was hurt by somebody who was French and therefore I can't believe that anybody would ever visit France?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like if you said that, people would say, well, you're bigoted or you're crazy. And so just sort of encouraging people to push back and then tell a better story.
Do you think that, and you talked a lot about the mainline church, and for those who, for those who are listening who don't know, mainline churches like the United Methodist Church or the UCC or the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America are generally more progressive in their theology. And I talk about this a little bit in my book too, but and you just said something that really struck me in that it seemed like the mainline church has just not done a very good job of telling a better story. Do you have any sense of why that is?
I think we got embarrassed and we got defensive. And in some ways, the mainline church values won the cultural war in many ways. Like, so while Christianity got represented by a theology that was not ours, many of the sort of liberal Christian values got accepted in the schools and the villages and the towns. I mean, I know we don't feel like that maybe at this moment in history, but, you know, in some ways, like when you made the case for your religion, if you don't talk about God and all you say is like, we're really nice people and we have a really good choir, that's kind of what we did, right? Because we didn't want to say the God piece because we didn't want to sound like those other ignorant Christians, right? And I think in some ways we thought, well, does it even matter? You know, haven't we sort of won the battle here and we don't even need to do the God thing? And I think there is a way in which the Holy Spirit and God got dropped by many mainline denominations as they sort of tried to stand opposed to some other version of Christianity that they didn't want to be associated with.
You mentioned this earlier, so maybe you already answered this, but when you talked about that you're not opposed to confession and repentance, but I'm wondering if you have thoughts on how should Christians respond when either they fail as individuals or if they do experience or observe failures today in their own tradition?
Yeah, so I think every preacher is preaching the sermon that they need to hear. You know, so we're always kind of preaching to ourselves, right? And what I sort of say to my own people, I was obviously one of those people who did apologize all the time. I mean, I was embarrassed by the perceptions of Christianity. I thought I was smarter and better than that. You know, I didn't want to be outed in those ways. So I'm talking to myself here, you know, reminding myself. But I do feel like the beautiful things about the Christian tradition are bigger than this moment in time and bigger than we are. And that is what we have to offer. And so I love talking about history and tradition and liturgy and all of that stuff. And one of the most beautiful things we have is this bizarre thing we do every week, confession. You know, where we actually like do this painful thing, which is look at the 7 days that have passed and admit those things we've done, which we ought to have left undone, and acknowledge the things we didn't do that we should have done, you know. And then we have this personal confession with God. And I find it very telling that some of our more sort of liberal, open-minded churches were very quick to drop confession if they could, you know, if they came from a tradition where you didn't have to follow a certain liturgy. And I think we always do that at our peril. We always do. And I know why they dropped it, because I think they were responding to the pain of people who had had confession and repentance and sin, you know, who had had that thrown at them in a really cruel and unfair way. And so the answer sort of was like, well, let's drop all of that. But actually, it's really important. It just shouldn't be abused. Mm-hmm.
Can you say more about when you say they drop it at their peril? Can you say more about that?
So if you don't ask anybody to say a prayer of confession, you're not going to say it yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of dangerous. And I think that let's take, say, the United Church of Christ. I mean, that's a denomination where we're experts in telling everybody else what they're doing wrong. And I think, you know, you can do some of that. Like, there's a tradition of prophecy and telling it like it is. But if you're not balancing that with the practice of confession and repentance, you're just going to sound irritating and like a know-it-all. And I think that's often how the mainline church sounds when it makes these pronouncements and resolutions, you know, like we're resolutionaries. Mm. We love to like get together and vote on these things and, you know, as if Congress cares what we think.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like nobody cares. Like we don't have that position in society, but we're going to kill each other over these, you know, fine points of parliamentary procedure. But we're going to drop confession because that's judging.
Yeah.
So I don't know. In my denomination, you know, we have some freedom. So we can do really amazing creative things, and then we can also really mess it up and make it bad. And so, you know, there are UCC churches that don't have prayers of confession. I've had people say, like, you know, here's something I have a real problem with in the church, like the prayer of confession. It's so judgmental. And the old Lillian would have been like, I know, I'm so sorry. You know, I feel your pain. But now I'm like, really? Like, you didn't do anything wrong? Mm-hmm. You know? Well, I guess you could make your grocery list, but the rest of us will be reflecting on our shortcomings.
Is there a moment for you when you talk about the old Lillian? Is there a moment for you where you made that decision where I'm not going to apologize anymore? Was it a sudden thing, or was it a gradual thing, or was there something that kind of, what moved you to be, I guess, the new Lillian?
Well, in the Christian story, you're always a new Lillian, right? Sure. That's the beauty of confession. Every week I get to have a new life, you know, that I really believe that that's the heart of the gospel. Everyone gets to grow and change in every moment. But I think being a pastor and actually hearing the stories of the people who were joining my church and starting to understand that so many of the conversations that clergy have are internal, internecine conversations that have nothing to do with the questions of the people in the pews, particularly the unchurched or the ones who've been away from church. So we're up there telling people what kind of church we're not and how our theology differs from this other theology. And they're wondering, like, hey, when the minister's up there praying, who does she think she's talking to? And we'll say, well, I'll tell you who I don't think I'm talking to. I don't think I'm talking to God the Father with the long white beard. And, you know, but they want to know, like, what do you think you're doing with prayer? And so as I started to listen more, I realized that so much of what I'd been equipped to do, the apologetics, the arguments, the, you know, the making a case for things, was all an internecine conversation that assumed that everyone had experience of church, and I just had to show you why mine was better and not like those other bad ones. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was prepared to explain to people why the Congregational Church of the Salem Witch Trials, you know, was bad, and we had learned from that. And, you know, that was, but like, who do you think you're talking to when you're praying? Mm-hmm. That's a much more basic question. I think it's a great thing too. So increasingly, as we have people coming to the church, like at your church, and I had this experience more and more of people who don't have any religious background or haven't been to church in years and years and years, you do realize that the churches that were doing such a good job of welcoming the seekers and stuff, a lot of the time the mainline would look down on their theology, look down on this or that. But really, I think those churches did a great job of listening to people and getting basic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems like you've done it's the last few years, not only with this book, but your other, one of your books too, that When Spiritual But Not Religious Is Not Enough, that you've been doing a lot of listening yourself. And I'm impressed with your willingness, not only to listen, but your willingness to really get in there with folks about and have these conversations, even when I would imagine there's a lot of conflict. I was reading an article that you wrote in the Christian Century about engaging with the spiritual but not religious crowd. And I think I've mentioned to you in an email, I've never seen so many criticisms, or I've never seen so many online responses to a Christian Century article than I did for your article. How has that been for you to really to get in there and to listen and to share where you're coming from? Because I think you mentioned in the book that you got some heat for it, that some folks weren't thrilled with what you were saying. And so is that a place for you that's natural to be in that kind of conflict, or was that really hard for you?
Yeah, I don't think of myself as somebody who likes conflict. I don't know that anybody does. I'd rather be at home, you know, like just sitting with my cats than reading hateful emails. but I do tend to find myself in that position, at least with my writing. And it's interesting, in my personal life and in my pastoral life as a pastor, I don't like conflict, you know, and I want people to be kind to each other. But in my writing life, it seems like I'm sort of a hot button or a lightning rod. And so I have to deal with it there. or perhaps I bring it on, right? I throw chum in the water. But my writing voice is a stronger, more sort of strident voice deliberately, because you're making an argument. You're making a case. You're stating it in an exaggerated way to make a point. But I do think that, like, when I speak these things, I don't get as much flack. But when I write them, people get really angry. And part of it is my own sort of church family, right? The churches that sort of define themselves by their tolerance and their lack of judgment, they bend over backwards to sort of prove to the world and apologize that, you know, that they're, to show that they're non-judgmental. And for me to criticize that, or to make a case for why having a life of faith is worthwhile, even that they're threatened by, because they say, well, that sounds like making a judgment. And I'm like, of course it is. Like, we all make judgments every day. We choose things. But I mean, I'm genuinely as happy if somebody goes to synagogue because of reading my book. I really do think religious community matters and is worth talking about. But you know, from the open-minded church, people were like, you betrayed us because you made it sound like what we thought we were doing was worthwhile. And that's judgmental.
And it seems like, and I'm sure there are others too, who are at least offering criticism of the spiritual but not religious crowd. But my hunch is that you are one of the first to really, I don't know if it's criticism, but it's also just a willingness to engage and to have them really kind of, I don't know if defend is the right word, but begin, have them explore where they stand.
I consider that I'm respectful, that because when you engage somebody, you're respectful. So if somebody says, you know, all Christians are homophobic and the Salem witch trials could happen tomorrow and I hate Christianity, and then you respond to them and say, oh, I know you're such a deep thinker, I could really learn from you, you know, that's condescending. That's not respectful, right? If you don't believe it, if you go to church, obviously you don't agree with what they're saying, you know. And so I consider that I engage. And it was so interesting. The people who consider me judgmental are always outraged on behalf of some other group that they're not a part of. So it was always like clergy telling me, you've just blown our chances and alienated all the spiritual but not religious and unchurched people who see God in the sunset. You've just blown it for all of us by being judgmental. And I actually like have rarely gotten any pushback from somebody who's in that category. They generally are like excited to have the debate. And they'll push back to me and they'll say, what about AA meetings? What about this? You know, and we have a good time. And my mind gets changed, right? Like, I'm open too. But there is something sort of neurotic about churches whose only identity is their open-mindedness and tolerance. They're almost paralyzed. And I think that's a conversation that the spiritual but not religious people are not interested in.
How can you talk, you kind of, I assume, well, somewhat jokingly about you would rather maybe go home to be with your cats, but how, when you engage with the criticism, whether it is in person or when you're writing, what are the things that you fall back on to get you through it?
Well, it's always easier if it's not personal, right? You know, so if I can think of it as this is an argument or a case being made, as if it's on a stage or happening out there, you know, and we're all playing our role. Like, I really do believe the Holy Spirit works through conversations, and that if you can advance a conversation, you've played an important role, even if people don't like the way you advanced it. Like, I do think I forced a conversation within a lot of denominations on this question, and in doing so exposed how ill-equipped we were to answer the questions of people who check off none as their religion. Like, I don't think we would be thinking as much about, okay, then how do you talk to the spiritual but not religious, had I not stirred up some of that conversation. And I don't demand that you think of it the way I think of it. I think I'm just excited that anyone's thinking about it, because I think mostly we've been debating other Christians and, you know, patting ourselves on the back.
Is that something that helps you then in thinking about it when you're engaged in it, and even when it does feel personal, when criticism does feel personal for you, to are you able to understand and realize that I think there's a greater good that's going to come out of this? Are you able to step back and see that, or does that take some time to see that?
It takes some time. Like, I often don't know what's going to be controversial. Like if I think if I knew in advance what was going to be controversial, I might pull back on it. You know, I might say, oh, this is not the week for that. So you don't always know what's going to sort of get people riled up or excited. And I think it is kind of a Holy Spirit thing. And there's also times where you say, gosh, I wish I hadn't put it quite like that, you know. But in general, when I do write things, they are very well cooked. Like the spiritual but not religious article in the Century, that was 3 years in the making, that piece. And I gave it as sermons at my own church, at other people's churches. I reworked it. I tried out pieces of it in different formats. And it was interesting that when people criticized it, so many people said, you know, you should have thought before you published that. You should have edited that. Like, you know, you should have waited till you were less fired up, right? And I think, to be honest, some of that I think is sexism. You don't hear people say that about male writers as much.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, you're emotional. You should have thought before you hit send. But like, I really do think about things and I get a lot of feedback on them. So, you know, in talking about my imaginary conversation with the spiritual but not religious person, I'd had that real conversation many times. Mm-hmm. What I was surprised by was the reaction of other clergy who were so upset on behalf of their imagined spiritual but not religious person.
What is that about? Why, when the clergy who are upset on behalf of others talk about you've ruined it for us, that you've ruined it for the spiritual but not religious folks, is it because they have part of it, I would imagine, is that we all have our own stuff to work through, but that they've got their own stuff to work through. Is it because they are nervous about something, or anxious, or nervous about the decline of the main line? What is that about, do you think, for you?
Yeah.
Or that you perceive?
Mostly the last part, I think. I mean, I think we're all concerned and we all fear that we're being judged for the numbers. And so you have a lot of people out there who are like, wait, the denomination is going to throw all this energy behind, you know, Urban Village or this one or that one. And this will be like the sort of silver bullet that reaches the nuns. And, you know, and I think we get, we lift people up too high and then we get upset when it's not perfect and it doesn't all work. And there's a lot of people out there with a lot of anxiety trying to figure out like, hey, I didn't cause the decline of mainline Protestantism, but suddenly I'm a pastor trying to do something. And don't make my job harder, you know? And but again, I think it's a profound misunderstanding to think that these people you're trying to recruit are reading Christian Century magazine and are opting out because of an article I wrote, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I talk differently, you know, in that setting than I would to the person who's telling me they see God in the sunset, you know? Yeah, but I think also there can be a real lack of generosity in the church, and it's rather faithless. Like, if it's all about you and promoting your brand and your method, you know, there's a lot in scripture that would say that's really not faithful. And I love the letters, you know, like where Paul talks about, you know, one person plants and another waters. Like, I think about that a lot. That's a rich metaphor for me. And so sometimes if I'm taking a lot of flack about something, I think, okay, maybe I planted something and somebody else is going to water it and it's going to be this beautiful thing. And I wish that sometimes people would view each other more like that. But clergy can be a very anxiety-ridden group. And it's not easy to be a pastor at this moment in history, at this moment in time. So, I mean, my heart goes out to him, but boy, I think we can be awfully hard on each other.
Yeah. That's why I wrote a book on failure, so that I'm not lifting myself up.
No, I think it's really important to do that. And I also think that there are some famous pastors who write books that pretend to be about their failures that are like, you know, it's like, I mean, I used to always read a certain magazine. I won't mention the name, but, you know, it was a little bit more evangelical focused. But I loved reading the magazine because at least they were thinking about reaching unchurched people. Like, the Christian Century wasn't talking about that as much. You know, it was – and so I'd read these sort of different magazines. But it was always these megachurch pastors being interviewed, like, what was a great failure? And it was like, oh, I remember that after much prayer, like even after God had told me to pay for 10 billboards, I only got 8. And I'll always regret that small, you know, error on my, you know, it's like these kind of fake failures, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, you talk about that in the book too. And I laughed along with you as you were writing that or reading your writing about saying someone, I'm so tempted by chocolate. That's their version of being vulnerable.
Right. I'm a chocoholic. Yeah. No, unless you're saying that and you're obese, that would be vulnerable to say that. But, you know, it's like we pick these things like, yeah, oh, I just can't turn off the football game, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Like, wow. Yeah. And I do think that the people in the pews say, really? Like, that's your biggest problem? And again, they don't know anything about why we're doing what we're doing. And if the minister is just prattling on about that nonsense, people don't have time for it.
Well, especially, I'm making a broad generalization here, but in the work that we've done with millennials, I mean, I think that vulnerability and authenticity and honesty is something that they almost, I don't know, demand is too strong, but they expect and they desire and they hunger for.
Do you ever wonder, though, that there's almost like a cult of failure or a cult of vulnerability, that it's that in itself is almost becoming a brand?
That people go too far, you mean? Or
yeah, I mean, vulnerability, failure, or it's just like it's become the thing. Like every book, you know, on the back has to say this is vulnerable and brave. And it's almost becoming its own trope. That's what I sometimes wonder.
Yeah. So what I hear you saying is that my book is a trope. That's what I'm hearing you
say. No.
I absolutely. And and probably because I'm so immersed in that field, I wonder that myself. But I run into folks who still say, I can't believe you wrote a book about failure. Because I think there's some truth in what you say, but I still think there's a lot of the population who are pretty nervous about it want to keep it at an arm's length.
And I think our church members, particularly the ones who were raised in the church, they're terrified of failure. They feel like, you know, as lay people and lay leaders, they're presiding over this massive decline. And when they're not blaming it on the minister, they're blaming it on themselves. And they're saying, why doesn't my 25-year-old granddaughter go to church? What are we doing wrong? You know, so there is this generalized anxiety. And when you pair that with a faulty theology or like no theology, it's really deadly. And all you're left with is anxiety. And when I say theology, like I think that the theological stuck place for many mainline declining denominations has become works righteousness. We've lost a sense of a healthy sense of sin and grace and mercy. And instead we're trying to be the most righteous. We would never think that about ourselves because, you know, we're like, oh, we would never say our religion is better than any other. But we're telling everybody how they're wrong and we've got other forms of righteousness, you know. And I think that the people looking in from the outside, they don't see a lot of grace and mercy and forgiveness. Like if they read the comments on the Christian Century article and they're an unchurched person, they're going to say, whoa, like if these are the people fighting on my behalf, no, thank you.
Yeah. I really love the part in your book when you're talking about your mom and her role in your life. And there's a quote that I wanted to read here when you say, as a person who had failed herself in more than one arena, from some of her workplaces to her marriage, she was the person you felt you could tell your failure to and have it blessed, and the person that she, and this is your mom. And I'm wondering about, for you personally, your own patterns and rituals, perhaps, and when you feel like you have sinned or failed, whether it's professionally or personally, what are things that you do to move through that? You talk about confession, but also one of the reasons I love that quote is that it's so great for all of us to have someone in our life that we can tell our failure to and have it blessed. So could share about your own, like, what is your own personal ways of getting through failure?
Yeah. So I think works righteousness doesn't work, right? and just working harder doesn't work. I mean, there have been times in my ministry where I think I wasn't just apologizing for Christianity, but I was apologizing for like myself. And I thought, if you are a pastor of a growing church, there's this sort of anxiety that's placed upon you by everyone looking at you and saying, what are you doing? And this and that. And so often, a lot of it is luck and sort of things you don't have any control over, you know, but, and same with writing, right? Like you put these ideas out there, you don't know what's going to be popular, what's not. I'd like to tell you, I thought it all through in advance, but of course I didn't know. And so all of a sudden, you know, the spotlight is on you in whatever way it is. And I think clergy always have some of that. And then you get the criticisms. And so you just think, I'll just keep doing more. I'll just run harder. And you know, I'm sorry I wrote a book that's really popular. I'll make it up to you by being even more engaged here locally in the church. And all of a sudden you hit this wall where you have nothing. Like there's no you left. So that's, you know, that doesn't work. Like that didn't work for me. I've tried it. Yeah. And I think everybody needs to have a few vocational crises. I mean, my call to ministry began with a huge failure and, you know, a vocational crisis. And I've had those at other times. And you come out on the other side of them. I mean, I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And when I say vocational crisis, it's that moment where you say, wow, am I even meant to do this? Like, I screwed that up so badly. Or it looks like I'm successful, but I'm miserable. You know, you ask those questions, like, is this really my calling? And in the last one that I went through, I came out on the other side saying, I really do think I'm called to be a pastor, but I've got to do it differently. And the old, you know, that sort of constant apologizing, overcompensating, that whole rabbit wheel that the churches can get on, it's not good for any of us. And it was, you know, yeah, so I think we're constantly, you know, receiving the gift of humiliation as pastors. and that's one reason why I do love being a pastor. Like there were points where people said, well, why don't you just write books? And to me, that would be miserable. And I also think I might become really obnoxious, you know, or more obnoxious than I am. Because that's the thing about, you know how that is. Like you can write a book, but no one in your church cares about that.
I've learned that very well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, like they don't care. And then if they buy your book, they're like mad at you because they're like, well, we've heard all this before. Yeah. I'm like, I didn't tell you to buy it. I tell my church members, don't buy the book. Like you've either heard it or you will hear it. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, so that's the thing about Christian community too. And everybody I think gets that. Like you have the CEO of the company who's on the same committee with the person who can barely pay their rent. And they both get a say and they're both washing out the communion plates together. Like, you know, and I can write a book and they're still going to complain to me that there's no like toilet paper in the men's room. You know, that's sort of the beauty of community, right?
Right. Well, we were talking about Father James Martin and his, in my podcast with him. And he talked about how he's become pretty well known. And when he goes and speaks and gets standing ovations, but then he goes back with his brothers and he said, if I said anything about how great things went, they would throw a dinner roll at me because that's part of being in community.
I know. And when I listened, that was a great podcast you did. Great interview, by the way. And when I listened to it, I found myself like feeling this moment of jealousy, like, well, I want to live with Jesuit brothers who, you know, like, because I think for those of us who don't live in community like that, we really have to go out there and find those people who would throw a dinner roll at us and say, stop being conceited. Or conversely, I think more what we need is usually don't be so hard on yourself. Because that's what I think we do more of. I think most clergy are so hard on themselves. And that's why they're hard on each other. You know, like when I read these sort of mean emails or whatever that clergy write to me, I'll stop and say, oh my gosh, but imagine what they say to themselves. You know, it would be hard to live in that head.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you have to sort of seek that out and put work into it. And if you're in a field where the market share is shrinking and the numbers are against you, et cetera, it's so easy to slide into that works righteousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always end up my conversations with folks to ask them to share a failure story of their own. So whether it's a professional or personal or whatever, I was wondering if you could share with the listeners a story where you have failed.
Well, I was thinking about that, and I mean, I fail all the time, right? But the failures that upset me the most are when I hurt somebody that I care about. Like that, there's nothing worse than that, and particularly if you hurt a church member, or you know, and you'll find out that you hurt them because they'll lash out in pain, right? And what do you do with that? And for my own failures in that area, when I look at where I go wrong, like you have to look at your patterns and try to learn from them. And I think we all have these talents and gifts that we can also use as a weapon. So whatever you're good at will also probably be your weapon of choice. And so for me, I feel like, you know, something I'm pretty good at and kind of came in the world good at it. Like I can't claim that this was something I earned, but I always liked writing and I was pretty good with words. And so when I get angry, my weapon of choice is words, right? And I have to really think about that, because when I look back on the times where I've hurt people, it's almost always been like an aside or a funny little remark, sarcastic, you know, et cetera, that where like I forget that it's like I'm carrying a sword. Mm-hmm. And when you do that from the pulpit or something like that, that's when you can really hurt someone. And so when I think of my failures, like in ministry, it's when I've hurt somebody with something like that, with a word. And I don't know, you can't sort of promise yourself you'll never do wrong again. But I do think looking at the weapon you chose and how you used it sort of helps you. And so there are times now where when I'm really angry, you know, it's my way of putting away the sword or locking up the guns is I close down the laptop and I say, don't respond to that.
Well, Lily and Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me again. Her latest book is Tired of Apologizing for a Church I Don't Belong to, and I would highly recommend it. It's really engaging reading for folks. And so thank you again for being on the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much, Christian. I really enjoyed it.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Lily and Daniel for speaking with me. You can learn more about her by going to her website, lilyanddaniel.com. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast, as my next conversation is with the author Jonathan Eig, whose recent biography on Muhammad Ali made numerous best of lists in 2017. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.